Yeah, sorry about that false start. We resent the invite to ourselves. Yeah, we're very good at this, as you'll see.
Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes. And what helps them go always a little further.
Welcome back to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk. And this is RV10 double digits, Ben.
It's double digits. We've made it all the way. I didn't get to say g'day, Tim.
Try now.
G'day, Tim.
It still works.
Good. 10th RV. Staggering.
Milestone.
Yeah. Wonder if anyone's been here since the start. Remember back to those heady days of RV1.
It's highly improbable.
I think if you've listened to one episode, you're not coming back.
And an RV is a rendezvous point. It's a location of consolidation.
Every time.
And in our version of the RV, as you will firstly, you will remember from the first nine, we consolidate on previous episodes and also take questions from listeners.
And we've got a bunch of those, and we do very much appreciate getting the questions. debrief@unforgiving60.com is where you should fire any questions you've got, and we've got some crackers this week. Mm-hmm. But let's start by reflecting on the last couple of episodes, firstly with Susan Saliba.
Mm-hmm. Nakuru Hope. Running an orphanage, a school, and a farm in Kenya. Pretty interesting and very selfless stuff.
There were two things that really stuck with me. The first was that sort of catalytic event that occurred in the boat shed, which, as we discussed in the episode, is a very sort of highbrow, expensive, really good food, a delicatessen, fresh fruit and veggie place in the beachside suburb of Cottesloe here in Perth.
Sounds like we're sponsored by them.
I don't know. After that episode, I don't think they came off looking that great. It's actually a really good shop, but it is super expensive, and some of the clientele are probably a little elitist. Mm-hmm. And it was an encounter with an elitist lady who was concerned about the state of the kumquats in the boat shed that really caused Susan to think, we are living in this little bubble here in this gorgeous corner of Australia.
And that's the biggest issue
in
the western suburbs of Perth.
Absolutely, that cliched first world problems. And so Susan did something about it. And the fact that we all experience these little moments, but for her to actually do something so life-changing, so selfless, and to sacrifice what she has to start Nakuru Hope, I found inspirational.
I love the interrelationship between all of the things that she built. Remember, she started actually firstly with an initiative to teach women how to sew. And those women are now making the school uniforms for the school that she built to support the orphanage and, of course, the farm that sits in the middle there that teaches some basic agriculture but also supports the hungry mouths.
Feeds the school. It's a full service setup.
And doing something bigger than yourself, we're great advocates of that. She's certainly doing that, and very little for herself, including being single. Did we get any CVs, resumes, bios, full body pictures on anyone that wanted to date Susan or be part of her succession plan?
They may have hit our spam filter, but we certainly didn't get anything in the debrief at Unforgiving 60 address. But we're hoping someone special reached out direct, maybe.
Let's hope so. I loved her insights on what makes a good volunteer, her answer to that question. And surprisingly, being a volunteer isn't all about being a volunteer. She wants those volunteers to make a meaningful contribution. So it's actually those people that are volunteering, not all about you.
Quite. The other thing that stuck with me, I said there were two things, but then you went off tangentially because it's all about you, it seems, in this relationship.
Volunteering an opinion.
Volunteering your thoughts. Gratefully received. The other thing that stuck with me from the Susan Saliba interview was she said that in Africa, words are softer. Words are gentler, that the way they relate with one another and the sense of community there, that they don't take offence as much. They don't have that hardness to their words when they're dealing with each other, which I thought was just a beautiful way of hitting so many things. I think, and we've said before, that we're super quick to get offended in the West. We're super quick to take offense, to look for offense, to sort of maybe even give offense. And it's not a really community-based way to live your life. Whereas the idea that, you know, your words can be a bit gentler, you can have these discussions, but it still be based on love. I found that a really beautiful way of looking at the world.
Underpinned by dialogue and conversation. And I think that's the one thing that's often missing from our culture in the West, is that, you know, we can be outraged, but our outrage is on social media, this faceless beast, as opposed to having a civil, well-informed, educated conversation.
Mm. Deep. Now, speaking of human engagement, Chris Collard, I had an interaction with Chris of a different kind.
Mm-hmm. The details are on our social media for those that do follow at Unforgiving 60 on all sorts of, all your normal social media platforms, maybe even some abnormal ones. Picture of Ben's face after his Chris Collard experience.
Yeah, a unanimous draw.
Mm-hmm. And then unanimous drawing of the right hand of Chris Collard as the victor in that particular engagement.
So that was the first time we met Chris, and then we had a great chat with Chris in the studio a couple of weeks later. Your thoughts on that conversation, Tim?
I think the thing that I take away from Chris is that he is absolutely dedicated and structured. And that routine is a key part of his life. Even at the age of 44, he's building up for another UFC mixed martial arts fight. He's always looking for the next challenge, but through those challenges, he's hoping to inspire the younger generation to not make the same mistakes that he made as a teen.
But I mean, the thing that I thought was just so remarkable about Chris's story is yes, he made mistakes, but he broke a cycle. And it's kind of easy for many of us who have had a pretty, when you look at it, pretty privileged background. You know, we've had relatively stable family lives, we've had decent schooling, we've had all these opportunities. You know, you've still got to run with it, you've still got to put in work and all that sort of stuff to achieve success. But if you're at the absolute opposite, completely unstable family life, the thing that, I mean, drew an absolute tear to my eye was Chris saying that, you know, he couldn't remember his mum ever hugging him or saying that she loved him. Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of start, and then just all paths leading to, you know, hanging out with people, doing bad things, all that sort of thing, to actually break that cycle and to get into that path of, as you've just described, dedication, hard work, and, you know, pursuit of these amazing goals. That's doubly impressive, I reckon.
Turning away from all of those things that in the past he recognised as being negative influences and or completely bad or wrong.
And how do you even make that recognition that when you've never seen, you know, a very close example of what right looks like, how do you just forge that new path? It's super impressive.
Mm. No mindfulness, no breathing. No visualization before the fight.
I loved it. And so we're both big advocates of these kind of things. But I did find it super refreshing, Chris, just saying, no, just train harder than the next guy, and then fight harder than the next guy. That was really what it boils down to. The other stuff, I believe in it, but in many ways, it's kind of window dressing to just that hardcore perseverance.
Mm. I think we still would advocate some level of mindfulness, breathing and visualization in any case. But the correlation that I drew is that he doesn't do those things, so therefore there is no overthinking. I do think that overthinking is a bit of a societal problem that we have.
Yeah, and possibly anti-mindfulness. I mean, you look at its very core, meditation is not thinking. It's clearing your mind and being in the moment just to enjoy, you know, what is happening at that point in time, rather than, as you said, overthinking and worrying about the next step, or am I doing this right, or should I be counting to five on my breaths instead of four, whatever it might be.
I suspect in the ring, if you are overthinking it, the first punch in the head might clear your mind a little bit, Ben.
Yeah, I don't recall much about that. I'd rather not comment. Yeah.
A decent dose of concussion will certainly clear your mind.
Certainly clears your mind. And it's certainly, I mean, we had the conversation with Mark Walling, and he reflected that me getting in the ring with Chris was me trying to work a puzzle out or trying to figure something out. It was certainly a part of, you know, doing something that scares you and trying to sort of give yourself a challenge. But I do like martial sports. I've always liked boxing because of the fact that it strips everything away. There is nowhere to hide. You know, your shortcomings, you know, are very clearly pronounced for everyone to see when it's just one person or two people in the ring. And so, yeah, I do find that refreshing. It's humbling, but refreshing.
And I like the fact that, you know, he knew he had a certain amount of confidence going into some belt fights to be the world champion, that he'd done the work before he stepped in the ring.
Mm.
I think also we lose a bit of sight of that. We suspect that people are instant champions, this drive-through mentality that often permeates society, that you've got to be immediately good at something.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't really about the few minutes that he had in the ring. It was about the hours and hours he'd done before he stepped in the ring.
Yeah, and this comes back to that Anders Ericsson sort of by Malcolm Gladwell idea of outliers and 10,000 hours and all that sort of stuff, that there's probably no real concept of pure genius or natural ability so much as there is a deliberate practice.
Still feels fear after 70 pro fights.
Mm.
And one of the things that I found fascinating, you know, we weaved some of that commentary alongside the interview, the commentary that actually occurred during the fights.
Title fight, yep.
What I found fascinating was how I felt my heart rate rising just listening to the commentary.
Yeah, yeah.
Very physiologically interesting.
No, it is. Let's get some listener feedback.
This is a fascinating bit of listener feedback, Ben, from Peter. Neither of you know me, says Peter, but my enduring memory of Ben is from 1996 when I was a first-year Australian Defence Force Academy Air Force cadet. And Ben, you rocked up to a review in a cherry red Mustang and a leather vest. Ben, I think this deserves a comment.
Well, first thing, okay, I can definitely confirm the Mustang, which I still own. Although it's probably not as sparkly cherry red as it was back then. I can definitely confirm it was not just a leather vest. There were other clothes worn at that stage. So sort of try to unpaint that picture.
Leather
in your
vest
head.
And leather pants?
I do not remember the vest being leather. There is a chance that there was a vest involved.
Okay. Let's ask a really simple question. Did you ever own a leather vest?
No. I can categorically deny that I did not have leather vest in my wardrobe.
But possible that you borrowed it.
I'm drawing a blank. I did wear some sketchy stuff. And I know you're a paradigm of fashion, Tim, so I don't know if you can laugh so wholeheartedly. But yeah, I reckon a vest is possible. I don't recall it being leather.
All right, well, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt on the leather vest. The Mustang, we know, does actually still exist as part of your life. Changing question a little. This one from Dale, who we know really well, ex-soldier from the SAS, both worked incredibly closely with this guy who is incredibly professional. He asks a question on instilling efficiency within a team. Talks about frustration with inefficiency through the years and wonders how we might get to a point where organisationally, inside that big word teamwork, we can just start to promote efficient behaviours. Specifically, he cites meetings and emails, which is a perennial problem in any organisation. Thoughts on how to become more efficient?
The meeting one is a classic, and I don't think any of this is news to anyone. We all know that meetings tend to go for far too long, that very rarely do they have an agenda or agreed out or desired outcomes. But just by setting those frameworks in your meetings, time limits, agendas and outcomes, you can generate a whole bunch of efficiency. The other thing I like are these ideas of formalized ritual descent, where you actually nominate someone to be the devil's advocate, the red team, to the point being discussed, to try and combat that groupthink. And confirmation bias can exist in so many, particularly hierarchical organizations.
Yes, pick the biggest troublemaker.
Yeah,
the biggest dissenter.
And, you know, it changes the whole dynamic from someone coming up with a contrarian view as being seen as a troublemaker, or being seen as poking holes in the plan, to being seen as actively trying to improve it by looking at the worst case. Anne-Marie Grisogono, we've mentioned her before, Dr. Anne-Marie, tells us that we should ask that question: how would I know I was wrong about this? You know, so instead of looking for that confirmation bias, you know, the signs that our plan is brilliant and going well, we should be actively identifying and then searching for those weak signals that would indicate that our fundamental assumptions were wrong, that our plan is not going to work out how we hoped it would.
I recently read about Elon Musk, who sent an email across the Tesla workforce talking about improving efficiency, being better at the conduct of meetings. Three key things from memory. One, no large meetings. Two, if you're not adding value to a meeting, leave. And three...
Does that count for podcasts as well?
Well, you're certainly not adding value. And the third one is no frequent meetings. So the one I really like out of those three is, if you're not adding value to a meeting, leave. Now, that's not rude. What he says is that you should announce that, look, I'm not creating any additional value, whether it's a meeting or a teleconference, and tune out. And what that does is it better focuses the meeting arranger,
mm-hmm. host,
the meeting host, to be more selective about the people that they do invite.
Mm. Or you could just start drawing during the meeting, which Dale would probably remember I'd do occasionally.
Yes, and I ran a workshop a little while ago, and we were going to do mere introductions at the start of the workshop. Ben was absorbed in his drawing as I was doing the introductions, and I threw to Ben for his introduction of himself.
And it came off seamlessly.
And he stood up trying to take control of the workshop.
Yeah, so maybe you pay attention in there somewhere.
Well, paying attention is probably important.
Unless you're not adding value.
Unless you're not adding value, in which case...
leave. I probably should have. Our next question's from Aaron. Aaron puts a really interesting question out there. And this is based on an Instagram post that he saw from my brother Dan, who spoke about the high prevalence of sociopathy and psychopathy, psychopaths in special forces compared to the general population. Aaron wonders if we've ever come across sociopaths in our travels. Tim?
I'm sure we have, but like all things, they're rational and balanced inside the special forces fraternity.
I love that Dave Grossman analogy about sheep's wolves and sheepdogs, that the vast majority of society are sheep, which is not meant in a derogatory sense. It's meant to mean, you know, they don't want to do one another harm. And then of the other small percentage, there's an element that are wolves who actually actively want to do harm, and there's an element that are sheepdogs who can do harm without empathy, can commit violence without that sort of normal, awful sort of recoil that most humans have. But are able to control when they apply that violence. So I think that's a really interesting way of looking at those psychological profiles of the kind of people who either end up as serial killers or war heroes.
We also don't like boxes and labels. And you'll remember in the unit, there was a phrase that was popularized by one of the commanding officers, confidence, not arrogance. Now, there's a very fine line between confidence and arrogance, and all of those sorts of simplification of language. I suspect that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. One might think a person sits on that side of the equation, and the reverse is also true. We also have a future episode coming up with a general who says that arrogance is a necessary trait of a military officer.
Yeah, it's interesting. And as you say, it's not that simple black and white sort of reductionist thing. We've spoken before also about the snakes in suits concept of some very successful business CEOs share some psychological traits with sociopaths. And so there is something in there, that idea that, you know, at some point to be clinically successful, you do have to temper that natural human empathy, you know. But yeah, as you say, I don't think it's a binary thing. I don't think it's on or off in many cases. There is a continuum. Our next question is almost at the other end of the spectrum, and it's from Phil, who, based on the Susan Saliba episode, reflects that Susan shows some pretty exemplary servant leadership, highlighting the deep personal costs that have come to her as a result of the choices she's made and the leadership she's displayed. Phil has posed a question to us. Who is the GOAT servant leader, greatest of all time servant leader?
Okay, well, let's quickly rewind to leadership as a contact sport and maybe reflect on what is servant leadership. Let's get that definition clear.
Servant leadership is leading in such a way that you're improving your subordinates. So you're not using them as a means to your own end, but you are achieving your end by serving them, by finding out what their requirements are in order to improve them in the achievement of the organisational goal.
Yeah, where the main goal of the leader is to serve, simply stated. Mm. So if that's the case, that definition for me, bearing in mind that leadership in our definition is a transference of both time, one's personal time, and energy, one's personal energy, I'd go one step further and say that a true servant leader, i.e. the greatest of all time, will transfer time and energy for no personal gain.
We saw a great example of that in our discussion with Song's Tattoo, and he mentioned that Nelson Mandela had him and his family to lunch twice. And, I mean, that is dictionary definition of what you've just described, Tim. Absolutely no personal gain to Nelson Mandela by doing that. It sounded the way Sans Tattoo described it as a genuine human gesture, one that he knew would be valuable to other people and one that he gave freely and willingly.
It's different to portfolio up who the greatest of all time might well be, because you would want to dissect the characteristics, the traits that each leadership showed. I mean, you could be a great communicator and inside my definition not be a fantastic leader. I wonder.
I also think, you know, one thing that I think every parent struggles with is you know, raising your children, raising them well. And I think the sacrifice that parents make, you know, that when done well is an example of servant leadership. I mean, you are transferring that energy, trying to transfer that knowledge. You know, I guess there's some sort of benefit for yourself out of it, but ultimately you are doing that to make another person a better human being.
Mm. So, teachers?
Good teachers.
Good teachers.
Good parents.
Good parents.
And Phil himself, in a subsequent discussion, spoke about some of the famous religious leaders. You know, Jesus Christ is an obvious one in the Christian faith.
Mm. He cites Gandhi.
Yeah, yep. All the classics.
Mm-hmm. And I also think that, you know, receiving some form of financial recompense doesn't exclude you from being a servant leader.
No, I don't think so. And as listeners would know, I'm a fan of Stoicism, the Stoics, a number of whom were very successful and very rich. Marcus Aurelius was an emperor. It's certainly not mutually exclusive with servant leadership, and some would argue that positions of power and financial wealth allow greater benevolence simply because you've got the means and the leverage to impact more people.
And higher profile. They enable you to be identified. That may then enable you to push forward on causes that previously would 100%. Not be known, not be recognised.
And we see that all around the world, from Twiggy Forrest here in Western Australia through to Bill Gates with his work right. in the malarial or anti-malarial work. Yeah, so those certainly give you leverage, and just because you are rich, famous, successful doesn't, as I said, it's not mutually exclusive with the concept of servant leadership.
And we'd love to hear your opinion as well. The greatest of all time servant leaders, post on our social media, or you can email us at debrief@unforgiving60.com.
Exactly. Final listener question is from Corey, who would like to listen to an episode on cataclysmic failures and hear how people have learnt and subscribed and prospered post-event. I reckon that's a cool theme, Corey. We will take you up on that. But I want to hear about one of Tim's many, many failures.
The word that doesn't sit well with me is cataclysmic. Failures I'm fine with. Cataclysmic failures, I'm not sure that I've ever had a cataclysmic failure. What about yourself?
I've certainly, no, not to the point where I think, you know, that my life, that I wish that thing hadn't happened. All of the failures that I'm thinking about have been relatively minor in the grand scheme of things in terms of their outcomes, and have certainly been instructive. One that really sticks in my mind, and this is, it sounds a silly example, but part of my sort of, I knew from very early in the piece when I joined the army that I wanted to go to the SAS regiment. I knew that would be tough physically and mentally, and so I had this little sort of mental staircase towards getting that, you know, do a half marathon, do a marathon, do an Ironman, these sorts of things as little benchmarks. And I think I was at about the sort of 10K race mark. So early in the piece, that was the goal. And I remember pulling out of a 10K race because it was getting a bit much. It sort of hurt a little bit much. Mm. And the relief was instantaneous and immense. You know, the second I stopped running, I felt a lot better. The pain went away. But then the shame and the sort of, I guess, fear that, you know, if I can't finish a 10K race, then, you know, how can I do the next steps in the path? That stuck with me for a long time. And sort of, I think, in future sort of spurred me on that real shame, that deep burning, I guess, fear, if you like, was a catalyst to keep going in subsequent events.
Maybe there's a continuum of failure, and perhaps on that continuum are foibles and regrets, and I've got dozens of them. In fact, some classmates of mine from the Royal Military College had dinner the other night, and I said to them, do you know what? We had a really small group of female members in my army class, about 17 of them in a class of 166, and they were all just really fantastic people and tough as nails. Mm. Deserved a lot of respect. You know the problem though, Ben?
Mm.
I regret this. We never told them that.
Yeah, right.
I said that at dinner, and I think we all inwardly reflected that that's the absolute truth. They really deserve to know that in an environment like the army, which is incredibly tough, they deserve that respect.
And which reminds me very obliquely, we spoke with Phil Hayes St. Clair recently, and he started a new project where you can tell people that you think they're going okay. And Phil's called this initiative Be In Motion. We'll put links to it in the show notes, but essentially it's a way of turning that thought into a tangible handwritten message that you can send either anonymously or from yourself to someone that you think's doing okay. And I reckon that kind of thing can really help.
Other news? Travel.
Mm.
You're on your third tour into Vietnam, working with an oil company.
In Vietnam, down between Ho Chi Minh City and Vung Tau, which has just been fantastic. Great group of people. Great part of the world, obviously, both significant locations from an Australian military history perspective. The War Remnants Museum, which you and I have both visited this year mm-hmm. on separate occasions. Very sobering sort of visit, but also a fantastic lesson in perspective. You know, the narrative that you grow up with about any world event is so coloured by, you know, what side of the particular event you sit on, and this is a great example of what the other side experienced during that particular crisis.
And you've been down in Vung Tau in the Grand Hotel, not, quote, drinking tinnies in the Grand Hotel in a 36-hour rec leave in Vung Tau, unquote.
I can still see Frankie drinking tinnies in the Grand Hotel on a 36-hour rec leave in Vung Tau.
And you reckon that you found out it is the same Grand Hotel as was cited in that famous Red Gum song?
Yes, yes.
And super interesting.
And what were you doing in the Grand Hotel?
Running workshops. whether we were drinking tinnies, there were a few drinks that went down, but beautiful place. Obviously had a significant facelift since, I imagine, the Red Gum days. But yeah, really, really gorgeous place right on the coast there in Vung Tau.
And I was on the East Coast last week working with a chemicals company, simulating a horrendous traffic accident between a hydrochloric acid tanker and a school bus. exercise. That didn't really happen.
Yeah, that'd be a bad day in the office.
Bad day in the office for that management team who did tremendously well in getting themselves orientated to the problem, taking information, processing it, making a decision, and then critically communicating it.
Communicate.
Only three things that come out of a crisis management team or an emergency management team, and there they are. Communicate.
I reckon that's the end of our communication this week.
This communication is about to be terminated.
That's right.
And you're gonna do an Elon Musk up on me, aren't you?
That could mean so many things. What specific Elon Musk am
you
I
are no
do?
Longer adding value.
I ceased adding value at RV1, but I've failed to leave. But yeah, we'll sign off.
Couple of episodes coming up. For those that love their endurance sport, we have a endurance sports person who will never say die, just continues to look for the next challenge. And I've already mentioned a high-profile former general who has some interesting insights on life in uniform and out of uniform. Those two episodes to follow. Now, Ben, as part of the Sons Tattoo episode, Sons recited a little bit of The Man from Snowy River.
He did.
And we challenged him after the show to perhaps do a recital for us of the full and complete version of The Man from Snowy River, which was foreshortened in the interview.
Yeah, it was, only in the interest of time. And as you'll recall, Sons uses this as his vocal warm-up. This is his way not only of physically getting his voice box, I suppose, his voice into the game, but getting his game face on, getting his head into the space that he needs to be to go on stage and deliver what you and I have both seen him in action. It's a fantastic performance.
So he has accepted our challenge. He has sent us the recital. Now, I want to emphasise that word recital. It's not a reading. He didn't pick up the poem and read from a page. Mm-hmm. He, from his memory of the poem, has recited it. And showing that principle of trust, that great dividend of trust, he has sent it to us and said, do with it what you will. So I thought that the most appropriate thing that we could do with that particular recital of The Man from Snowy River by Banjo Paterson is have that as an outro to this show.
To break with our long-standing tradition of having an external song as our outro.
Footnote, externals, we still love you. Available on Spotify.
Yep.
This is not a paid advertisement for the externals. But here it is, The Man from Snowy River by Sons Tattoo.
There was movement at the station, for the word had passed around that the colt from Old Regret had got away and had joined the Wild Bush Horses. He was worth £1,000, so all the cracks had gathered to the fray. All the tried and noted riders from the stations near and far had mustered at the homestead overnight, for the bushmen love hard riding where the Wild Bush Horses are, and the stock horse snuffs the battle with delight. There was Harrison, who made his pile when Pardon won the cup, the old man with his hair as white as snow. But few could ride beside him when his blood was fairly up. He would go wherever horse and man could go. And Clancy, of the overflow, came down to lend a hand. No better horseman ever held the reins. For never horse could throw him while the saddle girths would stand. He learnt to ride while droving on the plains. And one was there, a stripling, on a small and weedy beast. He was something like a racehorse, undersized, with a touch of Timor pony, three parts thoroughbred at least, and such as are by mountain horsemen prized. He was hard and tough and wiry, just the sort that won't say die. There was courage in his quick, impatient tread, and he bore the badge of gameness in his bright and fiery eye and the proud and lofty carriage of his head. But still, so slight and weedy, one would doubt his power to stay, and the old man said, "That horse will never do. For a long and tiring gallop, lad, you'd better stop away. Those hills are far too rough for such as you." So he waited, sad and wistful. Only Clancy stood his friend. "I think we ought to let him come," he said. "I warrant he'll be with us when he's wanted at the end, for both his horse and he are mountain bred. He hails from Snowy River, up by Kosciuszko way, where the hills are twice as steep and twice as rough, where a horse's hooves strike firelight on the Flintstones' every stride, the man that holds his own is good enough. And the snowy river riders on the mountains make their home where the river runs those giant hills between. I've seen full many horsemen since I first commenced to roam, but nowhere yet such horsemen have I seen. So he went. They found the horses. By the big mimosa clump, they raced away towards the mountain's brow, and the old man gave his orders. Boys, go at them from the jump. No use to try for fancy riding now. And Clancy, you must wheel them. Try and wheel them to the right. Ride boldly, lad, and never fear the spills, for never yet was rider that could keep the mob in sight if once they gained the shelter of those hills. So Clancy rode to wheel them. He was racing on the wing where the best and boldest riders take their place, and he raced his stock horse past them, and he made the rangers ring with the stock whip as he met them face to face. Then they halted for a moment as he swung the dreaded lash, but they saw their well-loved mountain full in view, and they charged beneath the stock whip with a sharp and sudden dash, and off into the mountain scrub they flew. And fast the horsemen followed, where the gorges, deep and black, resounded to the thunder of their tread, and the stock whips woke the echoes, and they fiercely answered back from cliffs and crags that beetled overhead. And upward, ever upward, the wild horses held their way, where mountain ash and courage on grew wide, and the old man muttered fiercely, "We may bid the mob good day. No man can hold them down the other side." When they reached the mountain's summit, even Clancy took a pull. It well might make the boldest hold their breath. The wild hop scrub grew thickly, and the hidden ground was full of wombat holes, and any slip was death. But the man from Snowy River let the pony have his head. He swung his stock whip round and gave a cheer, and he raced him down the mountain like a torrent down its bed, as the others stood and watched in very fear. He sent the Flintstones flying, but the pony kept his feet. He cleared the fallen timber in his stride, and the man from Snowy River never shifted in his seat. It was grand to see that mountain horseman ride through the stringy barks and saplings on the rough and broken ground. Down the hillside at a racing pace he went, and he never drew the bridle till he landed safe and sound at the bottom of that terrible descent. He was right among the horses as they climbed the further hill, and the watchers on the mountain, standing mute, saw him ply the stock whip fiercely. He was right among them still as he raced across the clearing in pursuit. Then they lost him for a moment, where two mountain gullies met in the ranges, but a final glimpse reveals, on a dim and distant hillside, the wild horses racing yet, with the man from Snowy River at their heels. And he ran them single-handed till their sides were white with foam. He followed like a bloodhound on their track, till they halted, cowed and beaten. Then he turned their heads for home, and alone and unassisted, brought them back. But his hardy mountain pony, he could scarcely raise a trot. He was blood from hip to shoulder from the spur, but his pluck was still undaunted, and his courage fiery hot, for never yet was mountain horse a cur. And down by Kosciuszko, where the pine-clad ridges raise their torn and rugged battlements on high, where the air is clear as crystal and the white stars fairly blaze at midnight in the cold and frosty sky, and where, around the overflow, the reed beds sweep and sway to the breezes and the rolling plains are wide, the man from Snowy River is a household word today, and the stockmen tell the story of his ride.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60, that's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60.